Okay, folks, we'll get underway. So, welcome to TechEd North America. I say welcome, it's day three, four. Welcome to this session. We're going to cover an exam, or two exams, in fact, during this session. So we're going to help you get prepared for 70-410 and or 70-417, and I'll explain why we're covering both of those in just a second. Before we go any further, just introduce myself very quickly. My name is Chris Rhodes. I'm from the UK. I'm a Microsoft certified trainer, so I take these kind of classes. I teach these courses. I'm also a Microsoft Windows MVP as well. And what we're going to do, first of all, before we actually get stuck into those two tests in particular, is I just wanted to really set the scene with you about where we're at. A lot has changed in certification over the last 12 months, and particularly with 410 or 417, most of you are going to be starting at the beginning of that journey. With certification. So I'm just going to take a couple of minutes, I won't spend too long on this, explaining really the bigger picture, where this sits in the big scheme of things, and we'll have a little look at the anatomy of the exam as well, and then we'll really dig deep and have a look through the main sort of topic areas that you're going to be examined on during the exams as well. So we'll start with this. Has anybody seen this pyramid here? This has been publicized quite a lot now, so hopefully you've seen it. And what I'm just going to do here is just bring up the different certifications that relate to that pyramid. So at the bottom here, we've got the Microsoft Certified Solutions Associates, or MCSA. Now, MCSA isn't new, but we've revived it and given it a new definition recently. So the exams we're looking at today are all helping towards you get that MCSA. There are three exams in total, and we'll have a look at those in a second. But MCSA is really the building block. On top of that, if you wish, you can progress and do some of the expert level or MCSE track exams as well if you want to. And then if you really want to go beyond that, we've also got master level qualifications as well. But today we're starting off with the MCSA. So the MCSA is actually comprised of three exams, the 410, the 411, and the 412, of which we're discussing today the 410. Okay? You need to take all three of those in order to get the MCSA. We suggest you follow it in that sequence. You don't have to, but it's logical to follow it in that order. So most of you here in this room are beginning at that first step, and then you're going to probably progress on to 11 and then 12 in that sequence. But if you really want to do them out of sequence, that's fine. You can do that if you want. But you won't light up the MCSA until you've done all three. So for most people, that's a good starting point. For some of you, however, you may already be qualified in one of the technologies on the left. So I'm not going to read them all out, but we have things like MCSA Server 2008. So is anybody qualified on that? Is anybody in MCSA 2008? Okay, good. About a quarter of you. That's good to see. We've also got things like MCITP, Enterprise Desktop Administrator. So if you were a Windows 7 person and you qualified on that. Also, only these people on the left, you're entitled to take the upgrade exam instead if you prefer. The upgrade exam is 417, and we cover exactly the same topic areas as 410, 411, and 412. It's just that you're taking them in one test instead of taking three. So it's a little bit of a reward, if you like, for your loyalty and paying you back for the fact that you earned the other qualifications. So it's really up to you. If you're in that position and you've got one of those prerequisite qualifications, it's entirely up to you. You can take the 417 if you want, or you can take the individual three. It's entirely up to you. Okay, we're going to cover the same areas either way. It's just whether you want to take one big test or three smaller ones. Okay, it's completely up to you. So I'll take questions on that at the end, because I know some of you will have some as well. In terms of where this fits into the bigger picture, we already saw from the pyramid that you could progress, if you want to, onto MCSE. That's entirely up to you. You don't have to do that. But the MCSA is a building block for six of our MCSEs that we have out there. So we have things like server infrastructure, desktop infrastructure, and a few others besides. All of those require the MCSA as the foundation level. And typically, they require two more exams in order to hit those other ones as well. Okay, so for most cases, it's five exams in total. Okay, or two less if you did the 417. So let's take a look at the exam experience. Who's done an exam within the last, say, 12 months? A few of you. And who's done some prior to that? A lot more hands. Okay, so in that case, let me just give you a heads up, because things have changed quite a lot. As well as relaunching all these new qualifications last year, Microsoft also have really changed the way in which we're tested. So some things are kind of the same. If you've taken a test before, you're going to find some things are fairly similar, but you're going to find they're actually more rigorous now. So let's give you a little look at some of the anatomy of an exam. You can expect exams usually to be around about 50 questions. That goes up and down. So around about that, in approximately 2.5 hours, you've got about a couple of minutes per question to go through. So there's usually plenty of time in that respect. Your pass mark that you're expected to get is 700 points out of a possible 1,000. Anything above that's great, but 700 is the pass mark. Now, 700 doesn't actually equal 70%. I get a lot of questions about this. There is a cut score level, which we don't know. I don't know what it is. 700 points could be 56% or 84%, or I don't. Who knows? That could even change over time. They don't publicize that. I have no idea what it is either, and I've done this exam. But 700 points is what we're aiming for. On the exam day, that's what you want to see, a 700 or above score on your score sheet. Exam questions are graded individually, and you do not get partial credits. So if you got half a question right, well, you didn't. That's wrong. You either get the whole question right, or you get nothing at all. Okay. The cut score, as I say, can change over time, and we're not told what that is. You can expect to get a good blend of different question types, and this might be different for some of you if you haven't done an exam in over a year. You'll get some multiple choice. That's the kind of bread and butter questions you may have seen over the years, but there's also quite a heavy influence on interactive or innovative items. So I haven't got exact examples of those, but I can give you a quick heads up on where to look here. If you have a look at this URL, which is microsoft.com/learning/certification-exams, they have here some videos, like 20-second videos, that explain all the different types. Was anybody here on the first day of Tech Ed where we had a session on certification and you? Did anybody see that? That's worth looking back on and having a look at, because David explains all the different formats in great detail there, which I don't have time to do. But we have things like build lists. We have hot area questions. So really, we're just trying to spice it up and give you a little bit more fun on the exam rather than just a whole bunch of multiple choice questions. So expect different formats. If you want to preview what they're like, go check out the little mini videos on here if you want to see. And let me give you some tips. A lot of people come to me for questions during a course or during these kinds of sessions for how should I approach the exam. So let me give you some of my top tips. The questions on your exam are not designed to trick you. Absolutely not. But they are designed to discriminate. And by that I mean we're trying to discriminate the qualified candidate and have that person stand out, and we want those people to pass. And we want to distinguish those people away from the unqualified candidate, the person that's just going to have a go without really being prepared and doesn't know the product. That is what the exam questions are designed to do, to sift out the qualified from the unqualified candidate. We're not trying to trick you. There are no trick questions or there are no trick answers. Okay? The questions are designed just simply to say, do you know the technology? If you know it, then you'll know the answer. If you don't really truly know the technology, you're going to get caught out by a distractor. So best practice, a lot of people ask about this. Is it worth studying best practice? Not really. You're going to have an exam question that asks you to perform a specific task or show how to do a specific configuration. That may or may not be anything to do with best practice in the real world. All right, forget that. That's not what we're asking. We are asking a specific question on the exam. How do you perform this task? And we'll expect you to carry that out, even if that's against the grain of best practice, perhaps. To review or not to review, you have a certain amount of time to answer your questions. You'll probably find there's time left over. What I would personally do is, if I'm not 100% sure of an answer, I always click that box that says mark for review. And then I'll go back and review the ones I was uncertain upon. And that might be 5 or 6 questions out of the whole test. You can, if you wish, go back over every single question. You can go back through them as many times as you want. My one tip here, though, is to be careful, because it's actually quite easy to talk yourself out of what is probably the right answer. My advice is, go with your gut reaction. That's usually the right answer. If you're not entirely sure, go with your gut reaction that you put down first of all. I don't change them. Once I've committed an answer, I never go back. Okay? Unless I've marked it. That's the exception to the rule. My main thing here as well is, check out the exam objective domain. I'm going to walk you through that and explain that in detail as we go through the next section. The exam objective domain is there to tell you what you will be examined upon. Okay? There should be no surprises on the exam. You should be walking into that exam room knowing precisely what they're going to ask you. Not the exact question, of course, but the topic areas. So that's the most important takeaway here, is to have a look at the exam objective domain and thoroughly go through it point by point by point, so you know precisely what to expect on the day. And that gives you a really good chance in terms of studying to go catch up on those areas that you're not familiar with or you don't do that much of during your daily job. Okay, so I'll go through and spend some more time on that in just one sec. So the OD, as we call it, the exam objective domain, is found on the web. If you go to microsoft.com/whack-learning, you can look up any of the exams on there. And specifically, the area I want you to look at there is the skills being measured section. Okay, do check that out, because that's where we have all the sub-bullet points about what you'll be assessed on. Use that to structure your revision time, to identify any gaps in your knowledge, and to go away and read up on some of those areas. You should be walking into the exam prepared on all of the subsections. Don't skip a few. Don't think, oh, well, I'll not bother revising that, because who knows, you could get a whole bunch of questions on that particular one area. So you need to be very thorough when you go through that OD area. Okay, so let's move on to the 410. So as such, when I talk about 410 here, I'm in effect, for those of you wanting to do 417, I am describing one-third of your 417 exam here, okay? So for the other remaining parts of 417, you want to look back on our recording of 411 and 412 that we did the other day as well to complete the set. So let's have a look at the anatomy, really, of the 410 exam and what those areas are. The exam OD tells us that we have six areas, okay? Here are those six areas. Each of those areas is graded with between 15 and 20% of your exam marks allocated to each section. So that can vary, and that's partly down to the pool of questions that you get on the day. You might get a few more questions from one section than you might another. It's just the luck of the draw. So it's approximately 15 to 20% for each of the six areas. I know it doesn't add up if you do 6 times 20, but that's why it's a variable figure. So we're going to have a look through those now. We're going to have a look at installing and configuring servers. We're going to have a look at configuring server roles and features. We're going to talk about Hyper-V and how we configure that. We're going to talk about deploying and configuring core network services, installing and administering Active Directory, and finally, creating and managing group policy. Those are our six main topic areas covered on the test. Okay? So those at which you should be fluent with before taking the exam. So first of all, any questions before we start digging into that? Okay, so let's have a look at the first section. Installing and configuring servers. Now, I haven't got all the sub-bullet points on here. You can go check the web page for that. But what kinds of things might we be asked then? So installing and configuring servers, they're going to ask us about how do we install a server. And now, there are several ways we can do that. For example, we could install a server in full mode, full installation, or we could install it in server core. Can we change our minds afterwards? If I've installed a server in full installation mode, is that it? No, I can change, okay? I can actually convert, okay? So actually, there's a third mode. Does anybody know what that third mode is? You have the full installation, you have the server core. There's like a mini, yeah. There's a sort of core mini version, which is sort of an in-between mode. And if you haven't tried that out, you should. You should see what that looks like. It's kind of a halfway house between full installation and a server core installation. So what is special about server core then? Why should we need to know about server core? Hands up who's installed server core. Okay, good, about half of you, okay. So what's so good about server core then?
Minimal footprint.
Minimal footprint.
Patches are really quick.
I'm sorry, say again?
Patches are really quick.
The patches are quicker? Yeah, there's less patches. You won't be patching it as much. You know, there's about 75, 80% less patches required for a server core installation. There's less disk footprint, less code footprint. So we should be using that all the time, right? No? Why not?
Certain applications require a GUI.
Also, not all roles and features are available in server core mode. Okay, so sometimes for a technical reason, we can't do that. All right, but you should know, the difference between when should I go for core and when should I not? When is it appropriate to use that, or when is it not possible to use that, maybe for technical reasons? Okay, you should be fluent in how we go and provision servers. So for example, one of the big tools that's added to Server 2012 is server management. So hands up who's had some practice with server management, server manager, I beg your pardon. Okay, well, all hands should really be going up there, because if you're not fluent enough yet, you shouldn't be taking the test. Yeah, but server managers are a very important tool. Not only is it the first tool you're likely to see when you log on for the first time, and you'll want to use it every day afterwards, but actually in terms of management, we encourage people to actually go and build server pools in here. So does anyone know what a server pool is? Yeah, gentleman up front. Yeah, manage single, that's a good description. We can manage multiple servers from a single pane of glass. I like that description. And in fact, Server 2012 is enabled for you to be able to remotely manage other servers by default. Okay, you can hook up 3, 4, 5, 6 servers in your one single console and manage that from one computer, whether that's one server or a desktop computer, perhaps, where you've installed the tool on as well. So you can actually do multi-server management in Server Manager. So we call that a server pool. So for example, I can add roles, I can provision roles and features onto remote servers without really leaving one seat. That's very powerful, in fact. It makes administration a lot simpler. But you should have experience with that. You should have tried that out. Try out adding servers into a server pool and seeing the kinds of things that you can do with them. But it also stretches out to other things about not just configuring it, but administering it on day-to-day level as well. So you might want to look at Event Viewer. You might want to look at alerts and that kind of thing across multiple servers, not just one. And one of the other areas which is really important here when you're provisioning a new server is configuring the storage for that. Okay, so what's new in Server 2012 storage then? Storage pools. We have server pools, we have storage pools. So what's a storage pool and why would I want to do that when I'm building a server then? Any ideas? This is a different logic to how you might have done things in Server 2008 R2. You can build disk pools. So you'll build a storage pool which encompasses several disks, and that could be a mixture of different disk types. So for example, you can even have virtual disks in that mix as well. And it allows you to do things like thin provisioning. So I might intend to install an application on my server that requires, you know, let's say a terabyte of disk storage, but I don't yet have an actual terabyte of disk storage. Well, actually, that doesn't stop me provisioning it and getting it ready for the application. I can thin provision my storage and add the disks I require for that later as the space requirement grows. Okay? So you should have experience with that. We do all that through Server Manager as well. So have a look at disk pools. There's all kinds of different disk configurations in there as well nowadays as well. So like, for example, there's three-way mirrors. Practice that. And some of you might be thinking, well, how do I practice that? If I don't have like a whole stack of hard disks, how do I do that? The way I practice this and the way I prepare for my exams is I spin up some virtual machines. And inside of those, I can provision some virtual hard drives. So it doesn't cost me anything to do that. I can do that at leisure and I can just add some virtual hard disks so I can play around with those features. Are you guys using virtual machines for learning on? You should, okay? You've got Hyper-V nowadays in Windows 8, so you can even build it on a Windows 8 machine and set up a test server on there if you feel like it as well. Now, you should definitely have some practice with this, because provisioning the disk storage is, like I say, slightly different, new ways of doing things, new concepts. In terms of the terminology and the technology that's there, definitely gen up on that stuff, because you'll be expected to know how we go about setting up the disks that are required for whatever role that server is going to perform later on. And I've put up here a couple of links to the hands-on labs that you might have, you might want to play with this week while you're here. So for example, we have Lab 201 and 306, which fit into this exam objective area, one of which is about the storage, in fact. So has anyone tried that lab, the storage lab? Okay, a couple of you have. Okay, so go. I would encourage you to try that out while you're here in case it's too complex or you don't have time to go and configure that stuff back at the ranch. Now, before we move on to our next area, I just wanted to throw in here a practice question just to see, are you ready? So let's have a look. Don't answer it just yet. Let me call it out. So I have a server here that I'm managing called Server 1 that runs Microsoft Windows Server 2012. The server has a GUI. It's been installed as a full server installation. And you plan to convert the Windows Server 2012 installation on your server to a server core. So we're going from full to core by using PowerShell. Okay? So which feature needs to be removed? Now I'll tell you now, the answers here are sort of semi-incomplete. We don't have the full syntax here. But which of these answers will allow me to switch from full to core? Is it A, server-GUI-shell? Is it B, server-GUI-management-infra? Or is it C, desktop-experience? What do you think? Okay, every single possible answer there. Someone was right. It's D. Nice one. It's B. Okay, it's B. We're going to actually go down using choice of number B. So we're actually going to take it down using that. But that's, like I said, that's an incomplete. Now, the thing that's raised up here is the fact that A, some of you didn't know that, but also B, we're using PowerShell to achieve that task. And that's an interesting thing I want to throw up here, because in fact, PowerShell is very predominant in Windows Server, as it is on every product these days. So I'd like to see really a quick show of hands to see who's fluent with PowerShell, who can, you know, maybe make a PS1 script, and who's fluent at using PowerShell commands at the command line. Not enough of you, unfortunately, raise your hands there. Everybody should be putting their hands up. I would personally regard PowerShell as a core skill, not just for Server 2012, but for everything that you guys do as administrators. Yes, sir, question.
Mm-hmm. And knowing every single stinking command. I mean, in all honesty, if something like this were to come up and I couldn't recall it right off the top of my head, and I'll give Microsoft the benefit of the doubt, I would bing it, right? You're not going to...
Okay. Good point. But you can't...
I understand that you have to test, that they have to test things in order to get discrimination between people. But, and that's not something that's trying to be tricky.
Okay.
But in all reality, I don't sit down after the 1,000 things that I've done every day and say, oh crap, I can't remember it off the top of my head, I guess I should do it.
Right, right. So there's a good point, actually, and there's a few point. In fact, there's a few sub-points you've raised here. One, nobody is going to expect you to learn every single PowerShell command and function, and to be honest with you, there are so many. It's actually quite amazing. If you do get-module-list-available, there are dozens of new modules, each of which carries a whole set of commandlets and functions inside of them. So there are going to be hundreds of new commandlets you've never seen before in Server 2012. Am I asking you to memorize all of those and all of the parameters that go with them? No. I call this one out specifically because this is the only way you can actually do this. Okay? This particular task behind me here is there is only one way you can do that. There is no GUI method to achieve that particular task. And to be fair, it is quite well documented. So no, on the one hand, I don't expect you to memorize everything, but what we are looking for is, do you know how to do this particular thing? Because it's a new feature, and we like to know how we go about changing over. This is something that people requested that they wanted to be able to do in Server 2008. You can now do this. Okay, that's what a lot of administrators like to build their server up using the full mode and then strip it down and get it ready for production. And that's really what this one's about. But in this particular case, that's the only way to achieve that task. So that one does stand out as something that I would go and learn because this is the only way you can do it. In a lot of other cases, you may have parallel ways of doing things. So, for example, I could go and provision some disks either in the GUI, or I could do that through PowerShell as well. You know, there's no right and wrong which is best to use, but it depends on the circumstances. If I'm scripting something, if I'm doing a build where I want to build a dozen servers the same way, well, chances are I'm probably going to look to do that through PowerShell because I can automate that and use a script to achieve it. Okay? But you should have some awareness of PowerShell as a whole. Okay, if you've never used PowerShell, then I wouldn't suggest sitting the tests, any of these tests, because it's a modern day skill that we just assume that people have nowadays. Okay, so there's actually a hands-on lab about fundamentals of PowerShell. I didn't have it on my list there, but I'd actually go ahead and seek that one out if you're not so fluent, so you can actually get up to speed on that while you're here this week. Okay, so let's move on to our next section. He says, here we go. So the next section on the exam OD area is configuring server roles and features. So first of all, you should really know the difference between what is a role and what is a feature. For example, Hyper-V is a role, whereas Windows Server Backup is a feature. You should know the difference between those. Some roles have dependencies on features. So if I install a particular role, that might spin up the need for several features to get installed along the way. Some features are just totally independent, and you can just install them all by themselves. For example, network load balancing. But in particular, we're looking also in this area at measuring some of the most popular areas, or roles, I should say, that a server administrator may want to provision. So we've got here the file server role and also the print server role. These are your kind of bread and butter roles on a network. You're always going to have a file server. You're always going to do some printing, I would imagine. So here in particular, we're looking at assessing How do we do that? How do we provision server roles in particular, but also specifically around the file server role? Be aware also, folks, that roles have role services. Just because you've installed a role doesn't mean you've installed all the functionality that goes with that role. There might be some optional functionality called a role service that you can go and put on later on. So in the case of things like the file server role, it's actually surprising. You can just install file server role, but you can actually install other things as well, like file server resource management, and there's a few other subcomponents. So do look through that. When you're coming and installing and practicing this stuff, go through and have a look at what other things are there. Some of them might not be used all that often, or you don't use them at all, but do spend the time and look out. When I'm installing a role, what else is alongside that role service that might be useful to me? In some cases, it's extra management tools and so forth. A good example of this is for the print server role. One of the things you can install along with the print server is the print management MMC tool. So hands up, who's played with the print management MMC program? Okay, about a third of you. That's an awesome tool. You get it installed on Windows 8 by default as well, by the way, so you can actually run it from there if you prefer. But yeah, print management is a really good tool that lets us set up print queues or connect to other print queues on print servers, provision new printers, and also to be able to do things like publish them in Active Directory group policy as well. So one of the cool things I like nowadays about printing is if I want users in a particular department to have a departmental printer assigned to them, I don't need to walk to their desk to make that happen. I can use just the print management MMC to create the printer, to share it, and then go back and publish that and deploy that through a group policy setting that I go ahead and link to wherever I choose in Active Directory. And that's an awesome thing. So you don't even need to go into the group policy management tool at all to make that happen. Okay? And that's one of the features that a lot of people don't see inside of print management, the ability to deploy to GPO. But print management is worth spending 10 or 15 minutes playing with, just going through all the different menus on there, because you can add remote print servers in there as well as the print server you're looking at. I could administer all the print servers across my whole organization. I could administer any print queue on any of those print servers. And a couple of things you will need to know for the test is things like how exactly we do that. How do we manage print queues? How do we also set up variations on print queues as well? So for example, who's aware of printer pooling? Do we know what a printer pool is? We've had server pools, we've had disk pools. We're now talking about printer pools. What's a printer pool? This chap over here, Alexander. Yeah, go on, I'm picking on you. Yeah, just in case you didn't hear that, you would create one printer that actually maps out to several physical printers. So for example, where I used to work in a big open plan office, we used to have three identical print devices on a table, and that would be configured as a pool. So when I sent my print job to the pool, I'm just seeing that as one printer inside of Windows, but it might come out of one of three different devices, depending on which way the wind is blowing, really. But they're all on the same table, so it's very easy for me to pick up my hard copy. That's a printer pool, and so you should have some familiarity with doing things like that. And also the opposite way. When I say the opposite way, what I mean by that is you could actually have one physical device and create two printers that map to that. So you, for example, you could have a VIP printer and you set permissions on that so only your VIP users can use that, and they might have a higher priority over the printer that everybody else uses. So they're both sending to the same physical device at the end of the day, but depending on whether they pick print queue A or print queue B, the job may come out faster or slower depending on who you are. So play around with the variations on setting up printers and sharing them as well. Also be aware of how we list them in Active Directory. Users like to be able to find printers themselves. Listing a printer in Active Directory is a very beneficial thing to do, but it's an optional task. You don't have to do it. But you need to be doing that consistently. So find out how we do that. Also find out how you use the location attribute to make it simpler for users to go and find printers, or to have the location attribute pre-populate search results. So when a user does a search and they say, okay, I'm in the New Orleans office, show me all the printers in New Orleans, then we can have that pre-populate the search results for them without them needing to type in New Orleans as a search requirement. So those are the kinds of things. It's not just setting up a printer and sharing it. There's a whole bunch of other print management tasks associated around this, around that whole print server lifecycle. I've also got on here behind me configuring servers for remote management. Now, when I say remote management, I did say about 10 minutes ago that by default, I could connect Server Manager to another server in my organization. Let's say it's assuming it's part of the same domain, for example, without any bother whatsoever. I can just add it in. So remote management is already kind of enabled in some senses. to allow me to use Server Manager. But what other ways are there to enable remote management? It's not just Server Manager. What other tools could we be using for remote management? PowerShell Remoting, good shout. Is that on by default? So how would I do that? How would I turn on PowerShell Remoting? Well, you don't have to answer, it's a rhetorical question. But the point is, find out how we do that kind of thing. Remote management also might be things like remote desktop. So I might want to connect to my server with RDP. Is that turned on by default? No, it is not. I might also want to connect using other tools. Some of the methods we've talked about, in fact, use WinRM. Who's heard of WinRM? Windows Remote Management, that's kind of a core thing in Windows that allows us to connect through different methods, including PowerShell. With WinRM, we can configure that to say who's allowed to connect to this server. For example, one of the parameters you can set with WinRM, which is a command line, by the way, it's winrm.exe. You can configure winrm.exe to listen for requests coming in from a certain set of IP addresses only. We call that the trusted hosts. So maybe you've got a bunch of management PCs that want to be able to connect to that server and administer it, and no one else can do that. Then you want to configure WinRM to allow the server to only listen from a bunch of trusted computers. And that's something that we regard really as a configuration task. When you're building your server and you're getting it ready pre-production and you're just getting it ready to put out there, ready for administration later on, configuring WinRM, configuring remote desktop, those kinds of things are essential tasks. Okay, not necessarily for everybody, not everyone's going to use all of those methods, but we're expecting for the exam that you have configured those things, or you know how to configure those things. Any questions around that, first of all? Okay, so let's have a look at a practice question around that as well. This one's around shared folders, in fact. Shared folders, as well as shared printers, is something we're assessing in that category as well. So here, it says you've created a volume on disk one on your server, and you've created a shared folder on that volume. You want to enable Volume Shadow Copy Service, or VSS, on your shared folder. What step can you take to accomplish this task? So before we go and answer that, what are we actually talking about doing here? Not exactly backups. Yeah, we're enabling for previous versions. So a user can go in here, they can connect to that shared folder, they can look at a file or a folder inside of that share, and they could right-click it, and on the right-click, there's a previous versions tab. Are you familiar with that? This is a great option. It's really good for user self-service because they can recover previous versions of files that they may have overwritten or deleted files they've deleted off the file server. It's an awesome feature, but we have to turn it on. So the question is, how do we do it? Do we do it in the properties of the shared folder and enable shadow copy? Do we use the xcopy command to enable shadow copy for the shared folder? Or do we do it in the properties of the volume and enable shadow copy for the volume? Okay, I heard C above all else, and you're correct, it is C. We do this per volume, we can't do this per share. Xcopy is a file copy command, that's not relevant. It's in the properties of the volume itself where we go and turn this on. Okay. So things like volume shadow copy come into play here. Even though we're talking about file server, this is related to the file server role. Also related to the file server role is things like features like access-based enumeration. It's one of my favorite things. In the past, you might have had a shared folder that you present on the network, and a bunch of users might connect to that and see the same files, even though not all of the users may be able to access all of the files. Nowadays, we can use access-based enumeration to say, if you don't have permission to actually see this file, then we're not actually going to show it you. So you can't even try and get into it. If you're not supposed to see it, we won't even show it to you in the first place. But somebody else who's got a higher level of permission would see a different set of files in that folder looking at the same view. That's called access-based enumeration. So make sure you're familiar with how we configure that. We're probably using tools like share and storage management. There's a couple of ways we can do it. Just one more thing, actually, before I leave this as well. It just jogs my mind. Configuring servers for remote management also can be down-level servers. They do mention this on the exam objective domain. Down-level servers, meaning server 2008 computers, for example. You might want to administer not just server 2012 computers. You might have a mixed environment. Maybe you've got some server 2012 and some 2008 R2 computers in there. So you're also expected to know how to operate in that mixed environment, so you can use what's called down-level administration and use the modern tools to connect to old servers also. So 2008 R2 servers are kind of semi in the game here too. Okay, now we're going to depart into something else here, Hyper-V. Who's got familiarity with Hyper-V? Okay, a good half of you, if not more. That's good, but not quite enough. Hyper-V is an important role service. It's been around a few years, but it's undergone quite a lot of changes now, and it's really its third iteration. We had this in server 2008 RTM was when it first came out. In R2, they revamped it quite a bit. We're now in its third iteration, if you will. So even if you have done some of this on 2008 R2, you need to look at the differences, and there are quite a lot of differences here. But can I just say, what we're asking you to know here isn't everything about Hyper-V. Bear in mind, we do have other exams that cover other competencies, and there is some overlap on this one particularly. For example, what's new in Hyper-V? Give me some new features. We'll talk, okay, I'll come back to that one in a second. What else? Yeah, so things like failover, we're not interested in for this. Look at the title. Dynamic memory, I'm going to come back to in just a second. Things like failover, we're not really interested in configuring here. We're not interested so much in things like Hyper-V replica, which is an awesome feature. That's not on the exam objective domain area for this stuff. What is covered on Hyper-V is the setting up, the creation, installing the role, configuring the basics on the server, like virtual switches. So if you want to have a computer, a virtual machine, talk to the network, you need to enable a virtual switch first for it to be able to speak over in order to get to the network. Okay, so there are three different kinds of virtual switch that you can create. There's internal, there's private, and there's external. Only one of those will allow virtual machines to speak to the wider network. Which one? External, well done. Okay, so you need to know the difference on how we configure those, and also, what are the requirements for those? So if I want to create an external network, what is the prerequisite for me to be able to do that? A dedicated NIC. Well done, sir. A dedicated NIC. You'll need a dedicated network card for an external network. What about a private network? What's the prerequisite for a private network? Nothing. You can have as many of those as you want. Okay? And sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes you want to have different separate test networks on your Hyper-V host. So the kinds of things you need to know here are, how do we configure the host itself? For example, maybe I've got a requirement to store my virtual machines in a different place than the normal folder. Maybe I want to put my VHDs in an alternate place. That's a server-wide setting that you can configure. Also, things like time synchronization to virtual machines and heartbeat. Those are things that we'd normally configure across the whole server. We're also going to look at how we configure a virtual machine. And as I said before, even if you've configured virtual machines previously in Server 2008, there's a lot more options nowadays. If you drill into the properties of a virtual machine, there's a lot more options in there. Some to do with networking. Now, somebody mentioned dynamic memory a second ago. Who was that? Over here somewhere, I think. Dynamic memory. This is a brilliant feature. I love this. This is one of my best things I love about Hyper-V, is that I don't have to have a specific block of RAM purely dedicated to that virtual machine. I can assign a startup RAM amount, which is a minimum 512 meg of RAM, and I can set a maximum, and the maximum can be really, really big. So you can have like a balloon space in between. So I could say, right, let's have a boot up. I only need like a really small virtual machine here. Let's give it a gigabyte of RAM as the startup RAM. But I'm gonna give it, let's say, 16 gigabytes of RAM as the maximum. Therefore, it could go out and balloon into that, assuming I have the free RAM, it can balloon into that. But it also means you can have that shared. Several virtual machines might want to balloon up at different times. So you can effectively have a band of shared memory that they can all fight between, and you can prioritize those on who gets priority on that. Okay, so dynamic memory means you can effectively have a higher density of virtual machines on there. It's really good, but do look at the settings on there. There's minimums, there's maximums. And we'll have a test question coming up in a second about that, actually, so we'll return to that in a minute. The other thing that somebody brought up a minute ago was VHDX. So let's go back a step here. What's a VHD? A virtual hard drive. Windows Server can natively mount virtual hard drives. You don't even need Hyper-V for that. But in terms of Hyper-V, a virtual hard drive is one type of hard drive that we can see passed into a virtual machine. What are the other types?
Native.
Yes. When you say native, as in? A physical disk. Yeah. So we usually call those pass-through disks. I might have a dedicated physical hard drive in my server on the host computer that I want to have presented to a virtual machine. We call that a pass-through disk. That way you get the raw performance of that disk dedicated purely to that VM, rather than storing stuff in a virtual hard drive, which then rests on a physical disk, for which there is a slight performance penalty for that. Not much, a tiny bit. But nowadays, we also have things like differencing disks. If you're not familiar with these, go seek them out or talk to me afterwards. Differencing disks, which allows us to have several computers share the same base virtual hard drive, and then effectively have top-up drives that are just about the differences from one machine to the next. So that's called a differencing drive. You can build chains of those. It's really awesome. We've also got VHDX files, which is a new thing. VHDX files are new for 2012 and Windows 8, but they're not backwardly compatible. So if you're thinking about exporting a virtual machine from a Server 2012 computer and then porting that on a 2008 R2 PC, VHDX files are not going to help you. You want to do that in the older format of VHD. Having said that, there are some performance opportunities there. There are some new features in VHDX files. So it's a case of knowing which is right to use for which circumstance. Perfectly fine to use VHD. That's not a problem with continuing to use that. Does anybody know the difference between a VHD and a VHDX? Size? Go on.
64 terabytes in a VHDX.
As opposed to?
2 terabytes.
Okay. So that's quite a big difference. 2 terabytes for some people was becoming a problem. VHDs used to be topping out at 2 terabytes. Now they could be way, way bigger. Okay? So assuming we use the VHDX file format I'm talking about. It's also possible to convert from one to the other as well. So those are some of the things around Hyper-V that you need to know. So do install it. Have a practice with it. Personally, I use it pretty much every day for running virtual machines anyway. But do have a practice with this. Know how to set up the different properties on a virtual machine and on a virtual network, as well as the host computer itself. Any questions? Yeah, virtual fiber switches, good shout. Yeah, we can do that nowadays. We can have virtual fiber channel adapters in there as well. That's all part of the config. That could be configured for a virtual machine as well. Yeah, that's a new feature as well in 2012. Virtual fiber adapters. Yeah, fiber channel adapters, I beg your pardon. Yep, has anyone configured those? Wow, nobody. All right, so you've all got a few things to go and check out tonight. So let's have a quick practice question on this and see. It's actually not too bad, but let's have a look, see if you know it. We have a computer called Server 1 running Windows Server 2012, and it's got the Hyper-V role installed. A virtual machine named VM1 runs on the Hyper-V server. VM1 is configured to use dynamic memory. You need to change the memory allocation settings for VM1. Which memory allocation setting cannot be changed while VM1 is running? So hang on, let me read them out. I like you, I'm straight in there. Is it the minimum RAM? Is it the maximum RAM? Or is it the startup RAM? This gentleman over here seems pretty confident. See, who would agree with him? You would be right. It's the startup RAM. We can only change that while the machine is off. Now, actually, this is kind of a little bit tricky here, because remember what I said at the beginning? We're not looking to trick you out. This is a sort of sample question here, so I'm not saying this is anything near as the same as doing the MCP. But be careful. This one's saying which cannot be changed. Normally in an exam, you won't get kind of a questioner asking you that in reverse. It's normally going to be which thing can you change. Okay, so don't expect this kind of thing too much. But these are the sorts of things you should have familiarity with. So make sure not only have you set up a virtual machine, but you've tried everything out around it. You've tried all the properties around it. You've configured it. You've broken it. You've rebuilt it. And that's a really good tip, folks. Go and build your environment. Build your test lab in Hyper-V. Tear it down. Break it. Once you've broken it like 5 times and repaired it, you're probably good to take the exam. Okay? That's a good tip. I run all my test stuff in Hyper-V nowadays. Okay, let's move on to our next section. Deploying and configuring core network services. Oh boy, this exam is pretty broad. Not only are they asking us to install servers, configure them, get them up and running, maybe Hyper-V on there, maybe file and print, but also a whole bunch of other core networking stuff as well. So in this section here, we're looking at Can you manage a couple of key services, which I'll come back to in a second? But also, are you familiar with how to configure IPv4 and IPv6 networking? Maybe on the server itself, but also for the broader network as a whole via the services like DHCP and DNS that support that. Now, I had a question the other day. Somebody said to me, do I need to know about things like IPv4 subnetting and how that works? Sure. You know, I remember back in the days, we used to do five-day classes just on TCP/IP, and we had an exam just for that. Nowadays, it's just one subheading. Okay, it's just one small part. Things have changed. The level of knowledge, the bar, has been raised. So yeah, we assume that you can set up IPv4 networking, not just on your server, but to the whole network as a whole via things like a DHCP scope. Okay, so yeah, you need to know about things like /24, but you also need to know about not just configuring it on the actual server, but also some stuff like transition technologies. IPv6 is on by default. We encourage you keep it that way. Don't be one of those people that turns it off. That's what I call an ignorant person. But keep it on there and also understand, really, how we transition. We're in this period now where IPv4 and IPv6 have been working in tandem for a long time in Windows and likely on your network as well. But we're also at the point now where we're starting to get to now have the situation where we need to bridge the gap between IPv4 networks and IPv6 networks or a blended network. So I'm going to call out a couple of technologies. Let's see if you know them. Who's aware of Isotap or Teredo? You are expected to be able to configure those as part of that exam objective domain area. Okay? So configuring for Isotap, how do we do that? So I'm not just saying, like, how do you configure the TCP/IP properties pages, but how do you actually configure for Isotap routing? That's part of this first bullet point as well. So let's move on to the next couple. The services here. These services here have been on your network for a long time, DHCP and DNS. And the good news is if you have been administering those for a while, not much has changed, in fact, as far as these objective areas are concerned. So if you've successfully set up DHCP, you've made a pool or a couple of pools of addresses or scopes, really, and you've also done things like reservations before, the good news is it's not actually that much different here. This is one of the so-called easier areas because people are generally familiar with this if they've been running a network for a while. Having said that, if that's something you've never done before, of course you want to set it up and test it. Okay? But some of these things have probably been on your network for 10 plus years. So if you've set up a pool before on Server 2008 R2, it's broadly the same here on 2012. We do have some new features in DHCP. For example, there's DHCP failover, but that's not measured on this particular test. We have other exams that call upon that. This one is all about configuring it, getting the service up. So the likely things you might get asked could be anything like, I don't know, making a scope, making a reservation, scope options. They also call out on the exam objective domain authorizing servers. Let's say I'm bringing up a brand new DHCP server today. That's not going to work right away. Even if I install it, I have to authorize the server before it will start responding. Even if I've made a scope on there and it's all configured correctly, unless I authorize the server, it's not going to work. That's a one-time task that needs to be done. Make sure you know how that gets done. Make sure you know how to build a scope, how to build a reservation. What about DNS? Who's good with DNS? Oh, not many. Well, DNS requires that we need to know a little about the different zone types on DNS. So we've got things like primary zones, secondary zones, reverse zones versus forward zones. We're also expected to know how to configure things like root hints and also DNS forwarding. We have things like conditional forwarding. And this puzzles some people. I'll happily take questions offline about this because I know it's a bit confusing. But there's some similar functionality that you can achieve through things like conditional forwarding as against things like stub zones. So make sure you understand the difference between what is the difference between regular forwarding, conditional forwarding, stub zones, secondary zones. It can be confusing. Like I said, I'll happily take questions afterwards if you have them. But make sure you're fluent between the different kinds and also that you've set them up. Make sure you also know the difference between a primary and a secondary zone versus an Active Directory integrated zone and why you would want to do that typically, especially on a Microsoft network. We also need to know about the different kinds of records that you have. So make sure you know the difference between something like a PTR record versus a CNAME record versus an A record. Again, some of this is not new. If you've got Active Directory on your network, you've got DNS. Some of this stuff has been there years. Maybe you didn't build it, but go find out. Go find out who built it and what's there and have a sniff around. if you don't get the opportunity to actually set it up yourself. Oh, also in terms of administration, make sure you know the different ways we can administer these things. Guess what? We've got PowerShell commands for this stuff too. Again, I'm not assuming that you have to know every single commandlet and function that there is out there, but you should get yourself familiar with the fact that we have got modules for pretty much everything now. So we have a DHCP module, we have a DNS module, we have a DNS client module, in fact, as well. And so some tools you'll find are actually being deprecated in favor of that. If you've come across DNS CMD previously, which is a command line administration tool for DNS server management, well, that's kind of being phased out in favor of the PowerShell commands. It's still around, you can still use it, but it's being deprecated now. We'd prefer you to use PowerShell from this point on. If some of that stuff is not so familiar with you guys, have a look at Hands-On Lab 208 to help out with some of these areas as well. Okay, so let's take a look at a practice question. Server 1 runs Windows Server 2012 with the DNS server role installed. Server 1 is joined to your Active Directory domain, and users that have computers that are also joined to the same domain are reporting that they're not able to resolve any server names. Okay? After troubleshooting this issue, you find that the DNS server IP address configured on the clients is different from the actual IP address of server 1. You need to prevent this issue in the future. What should you do? So let me call out the options. Should you configure a static IP address for server 1, create a PTR DNS resource record for server 1, or configure static IP addresses for the client computers? Okay, so most people call out A there. Let's think about it. A is the correct answer. Why is it the correct answer then? Okay. The other two, creating a resource record is completely off topic, really. So it's a case of, like, everybody's pointing to this DNS server. All your clients are pointing to this DNS server. They're all told to go to this one. Only the one they're pointing to doesn't have the IP address that you think it does. All right, so the easiest fix here is just to relabel the IP address for server 1 to the one everybody thinks it is. And then, once we've done that, because it's the DNS server, we can therefore connect to it, query it, and resolve records for everything else on the network. So it's a case of it's easier to change one thing than it is to change everything else on the network, okay?
Hey, I have a question.
Yeah, sorry, gentleman at the back first. No, they might have just put the wrong IP address on there.
Okay.
I mean,
it
would have had to technically, because to have the DNS role installed requires that you've got, or to have it functional, I beg your pardon. You can actually install it with a dynamic address, but to have it actually work, you need a static IP address for the DNS service. It could well have been, which is in fact the default for Windows Server. So it's possible, entirely possible here that it's not off the wall that way, because when you install Server 2012, it's going to have a dynamic address by default. You could go ahead and install a role of DNS on there, but it won't actually work until it's got the static address. So you could argue, well, this person just didn't do their job correctly. but that's likely what's happened, is because they haven't followed through with the configuration of the server correctly in the first place. You can run servers from DHCP addresses, but not the DNS server. Okay, that has to have a static address. All right, many, many servers like file and print servers, even domain controllers, could feasibly run from dynamic addresses. But the DNS server itself and a few others have to have a static address for users to find them. Okay, yes, gentlemen here in the show. But that could have been the case. Yeah, I mean, that shouldn't be the case, but yeah. So we're looking to, it really is a case of, do we change the records? Do we change all the other computers? Or do we just change the one server that everybody's pointing to incorrectly? And it's a case of, well, that's the easiest thing to do. Change the one server, and then everybody else is good. Okay? Okay. Now, one of my favorite areas. Install and administer Active Directory. Now, Active Directory is a huge topic area. We could spend like 2 weeks discussing Active Directory. There's so much in there. So let's scale this down for you. We're not asking you everything to do with Active Directory. So let's just focus on what we are asking or are being asked about. We're being asked about how do we go and provision and install a domain controller. So I'll come back to that in 1 second. We're also asked to create and manage the everyday objects, the users, the computers, the groups, and the OUs. Now, I'll come on to more detail about those in a sec, but let's go back to the domain controller itself. So how exactly do I install a domain controller? Walk me through that. How do I do it? Okay, server manager probably, or PowerShell, whichever. Okay, so what do I install in server manager? Active Directory domain services. Is that it? Oh, hang on a second. Let me stop you there. Somebody said DC promo. Okay, let me clear this one up. DC promo used to be the command line way that would kick off the provisioning of the next step of actually building that domain controller once we've got the role installed. That used to be the way we do it in Server 2008 R2. In Server 2012, DC promo is still around, but can only be used for unattended installations, assuming you have an answer file to go with that. You cannot use it in any other way. So if you want to interactively go and build in the GUI a domain controller, you cannot use DC promo for that. So what do I use? I could use PowerShell, or I could use the continuing wizard that comes up if I'm in the GUI there to go and finish off the next step via server manager. If I'm in PowerShell, what am I typing? Almost. I think it's install-add-ds domain controller, if I'm correct. It is quite a long one, yeah. But it's actually a PowerShell command. Or you can follow the wizard if you're following through the GUI. But DC promo, you know, watch out for that. That's only applicable if you're doing scripted installations with an answer file. DC promo cannot be used in any other way. It is still around, so don't misread that. DC promo is in the product, but it can only be used in that one circumstance for scripted installations. Okay. We also, as part of that, expect you guys to know about things like global catalog. How do we build a global catalog, either during that stage or afterwards, retrospectively? We also expect you to know about installing from media, or IFM. I can build a domain controller from scratch and have it replicate the database from another DC. If it's on the same network, that's fine. But what if I've got a domain controller going into a branch office? Having that replication for that first time come across a wide area network may not be such a smart idea. So you can actually take a backup from the main office, take it to your branch office, build your domain controller, and have it read in from the backup set the Active Directory database. So you don't need to replicate the whole shebang across from the main office. You'll still need to replicate a few things that have changed since the backup was taken, but install from media can save quite a bit of replication time. Okay? So you need to know the process of how we go about doing that and have a question on that in a second. Yeah. Are there any requirements like multi-domains?
Can you copy it from it's a domain to domain, so if you're building another domain controller in the same domain?
Yeah. Right, so yeah, the question is, can I do it from like one, can I take a backup from domain controller in domain A and use that to build a domain controller for domain B? Not really. You could if it was something like the global catalog, but really you need to have it from the same domain. Okay, the sort of the donor computer, so to speak, is gonna be from the same domain as the one you're provisioning. Same thing, no difference. But also, we can decide on whether we want to back up a domain controller or a domain controller that's also a global catalog. If we've backed up a domain controller that's also a global catalog, that actually gives us more options when we're installing from media, because I can restore that domain partition, or I can install the domain partition and the global catalog onto my target computer I'm installing from media. So that gives me a couple of extra choices, and DNS as well. So there's quite a lot around domain controllers themselves. Let's move on to the create and manage object stuff. Active Directory objects. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard of Active Directory users of computers. I'm not going to insult you by asking you to put your hands up. But there are plenty of other ways in which we can create and manage objects. So I want to hear about some others. What other tools could I use to administer users, groups, computers? PowerShell, okay. I didn't want to be the one that said it, but yes, absolutely, PowerShell. Or ADAC, good man, ADAC, Active Directory Administration Center. Okay, and that is actually running PowerShell underneath anyway. Please make sure you've played with that and you know the differences about what you can and can't do. For example, Active Directory Administration Center has a few features that you can do in there that you cannot do in Active Directory users and computers, like, for example, the recycle bit. It has that feature built in, which is different to ADUNC. Okay. Active Directory users and computers is the old school tool, nothing wrong with it, but it has limitations. It doesn't use PowerShell. Active Directory Admin Center does. So we're able to tap into more different things in that sense. We can set up other things like fine-grained password policies can be defined in there and stuff as well. So do have a play with that. But also, within these categories, you're expected to know how to do things in bulk. So the tools I've just described are great when you're doing a handful of users or computers, but what if you want to do like 1,000 or 2,000? You won't want to use a tool at all like that. You might want to use, again, PowerShell. You might want to use CSVDE, LDFDE, and do things by script. More likely than not these days, you're probably going to want to create a PowerShell script that goes and creates or deletes or modifies your objects. So again, I don't want to harp on about it, but PowerShell is an essential skill in this area because it's the way we do things like that nowadays. But if you still have things like CSV scripts, CSVDE is still around. LDFDE is still around. You can still use those tools as well. So you should be familiar with the different methods on offer. It's not always going to be, hey, just create one user. It's going to be create 1,000. So again, I've got a call out here for a hands-on lab that you might find beneficial. Number 300 is worth a look here as well. Oh, a couple of other things that I've just remembered here. Offline domain join. Who's familiar with that feature? That's not very well known about. I can actually have a computer that's out in the field domain join without ever having touched the network. Okay, if you didn't know about that, have a look up on djoin.exe. All right, you can actually create a computer account for a computer that may not be in the network and is never going to be in the network, or maybe might VPN in later or direct access in later, but for now can't join the domain directly, but you can do a two-part process of having it domain join using djoin.exe to create a file. You go take that file out to the computer in the field and have it domain join in there. All right, so things like that are in the coverage for this exam area as well. Okay, so let's take a look at the next practice question. This is about install from media, in fact. It says here, currently all domain controllers run Server 2008 R2. You install a Windows Server 2012 server. You need to promote the server to be a domain controller as well. You need to use the install from media option. What should you do? So again, all the existing ones are 2008 R2. What should you do? And the question here is, the answers are, create a system state backup from any Server 2008 R2 server. Upgrade one of the existing Server 2008 R2 domain controllers to Server 2012 and then create a backup. Or create an IFM backup from any existing Server 2008 backup program. Okay, B, pretty confident B. Why would it be B? That's true. We do need an existing one running Server 2012. Also, this has kicked up something else here. In terms of getting your first Server 2012 computer out there, there's a couple of other things you need to do as well. What else is that? AD prep. Okay, you need to run AD prep once or a couple of times. AD prep has a few command line switches with that, like the forest prep, that you'll need to do before you can actually install a Server 2012 domain controller into an existing domain. Okay, hang in there, folks. Last one. The last section here is create and manage group policy. I love group policy. I love it. I use it a lot, and I know a lot of you guys will on your network as well. But what we're asking people to know here is, how do we set up group policy? What are they fluent with the tools? Can they set up a group policy? Can they link that group policy? Can they also filter how it works? For example, you can do what's called security filtering. So a policy doesn't necessarily apply to everything in an OU. It might just be a subset of computers or a subset of users that group policy is linked to. Okay? So that's called security filtering. So understand how we link and relink. I mean, one group policy object can be linked several times over to multiple OUs if you want. That might be the right way to do it so it doesn't affect everybody. Or maybe security filtering is the right solution. Make sure you understand as well about some of the features that are relatively new. They were in Server 2008 as well, like starter GPOs. Has anybody made a starter GPO? A starter GPO is a bit like a template. If I intend to create, let's say, 3 or 4 policies which are broadly the same but have differences, the logical thing is to create one starter GPO, populate the common changes in that one, and then go ahead and clone out from that and build your 3 or 4 specific policies from there. And when you clone out from that, we effectively copy and paste the starter GPO into your new one. So it's a time saver operation. It's like doing a copy. Are we familiar with central store? Not so much. Central store minimizes the amount of domain controller sysvol storage by having a central copy of things like ADM files that traditionally live in sysvol. In the past, those were duplicated out for each GPO that you had. And that could lead to what people call GPO bloat, where domain controllers actually had pretty big sysvol, and a lot of the files are the same but are getting shipped around with replication. So the central store is one of those things, you just do it really once, but you have to do it. The system won't do it for you. All right, you have to enable that if you want computers to be able to go and use that. And modern day operating systems have no trouble at all. If it's there, they'll use it. So if you have a Windows 7 or a Windows 8 computer, for example, if it sees that there's a central store, it goes and uses it. You don't have to tell it to do that. We're also expecting you to know a little bit about some of the areas inside of a GPO as well. Now, I appreciate last time I checked, something like 4,500 settings by default in a standard GPO before you've added any other templates in there. I'm not expecting you to memorize all those, but there are a few specific ones called out. So, for example, the security section, audit policies, app locker, software restriction policies. There are a few on the OD area you should have a look at there and familiarize yourself with. For example, app locker is something new, or it's been enhanced, rather, in recent times, to be able to protect or restrict applications, I should say, that are store-based apps, AppX files as well. That's a whole new thing we have in there, as well as scripts and traditional MSIs and so forth. Okay, software restriction policies are a bit similar, but they have limitations on what they can achieve, but they're backwardly compatible to things like Windows XP computers, whereas AppLocker is a relatively new thing. So there are a few specifics, but more important than not, understand how GPO works mechanically. And by that I mean, how do I make a policy? How do I link it? How do I unlink it? How do I back it up? How do I restore it? How do I check on its health? Those are the things you must know above all else, but specifically also a few of the areas that we've called out behind me. And the final thing in here is configuring the firewall. Now, this can be done on a per computer basis, of course, but that same interface is present in GPO as well. So it's actually possible for you to go and configure things like port exceptions. In fact, here's a question for you. What else can I do in Windows Firewall? I could do inbound rules. I can do outbound rules. What's the third type of thing I could do in Windows Firewall? Turn it off. get out of here. You're going to fail. Sorry, say again. Yeah, connection policies or IPsec policies. Yep. So connection policies are about saying, when I'm talking from this computer to these computers, make sure we're doing it with IPsec. Make sure we're authenticating, for example. So yeah, the connection security policies, I think is the right name for them. They're configured in Windows Firewall as well, probably via GPO, so that you've got a common set of settings going out to all the computers. Okay, but that's very important. That's often overlooked. Connection security policies can be good to block traffic or to allow traffic, but maybe only if we're able to use certain IPsec settings in conjunction with that. Maybe I want an encrypted link between computer A and computer B. So those are often done, like I say, in GPO as well. So at that point, I think we've covered the exam objective domain area, or all of the areas, rather, I should say. But I have a question for you. Did you notice something as we went along? There was one word that came up more frequently than all the others. Not PowerShell. Good choice, though. There was one in the text behind me. I know we discussed PowerShell a couple times, so I don't think I had it on the text. That word was configure. We're looking to know, can we configure stuff? Can you set this up? Can you configure it? Do you know how to, like I say, group policy? Do you know how to create a policy? Do you know how to link a policy? Do you know all the things that you can do with a policy? It's all about configuring. Maybe it's configuring that server for first use and configuring its static IP address or configuring server core. But for the most part, most of these exam OD areas are about configuring that thing. OK? Okay. So the main takeaway here is learn how to do it. Make sure you've got the hands-on experience with using the product to do those things in the OD area. There's no substitute for that experience. You've got to play with it. You've got to get your hands on. You know, things like textbooks are great, but you can't do it all from a textbook. You've got to have test computers to play with. Okay, and my other kind of thing I'd like you to take away, really, is my call to action for you folks. Just go and book it. Whether it's the 410 or whether it's the 417, that combo exam, go and book it. You've got a whole day left in a bit at TechEd where we have 50% off all the exams. Okay, we've been maxed out this afternoon, but we do have some slots left for tomorrow. I'm not trying to big it up and sell it here because we don't need to. We're really busy for exams, but you can go across the way there, and you can go in and register today and take it tomorrow if you so desire. Hopefully, from what we've discussed here, some of you feeling, okay, that's great, I did know all that stuff. For some of you, you will want to go away and do some study, and in that case, for you guys, we've actually got some other books and stuff. I'm just going to get those up really quick. We've actually got a little lending library out also in the exam booking room as well. You can go and check out some of these books if you prefer. These are also available downstairs in the Microsoft store, so you can go buy them if we're out of stock. But do come and see us. We can loan some of these out for 24 hours. We have some left. But you can go downstairs and buy them if you prefer to have your own copies. Oh, well done. That man's already got one. Good for you. So go read those. Those are very useful. We have one for 410 and 417. Depending on which way you want to go. I've mentioned a couple of things like hands-on labs. Do come and find me if you have any other questions. I'm in the exam area all day tomorrow, just out front here, so come and find me or come and chat to me afterwards. Okay, other resources. One question that people ask a lot is, where else can I study? What if I don't want to go on a course? And by the way, going on a course is an excellent idea because it keeps me in business, all right? Keeps my kids fed. There is a course for both of the exams that we've described here. Assuming you're taking it in English, it's 20410 or 20417. We have 5-day classes on those that prepare you for the exam as well. But also, check out Microsoft Virtual Academy. There's over 1 million people using that resource, and it's excellent. MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com is a free tool, free resource. There's Windows Server 2012 courses in there aplenty. There's about 4 pages worth of Windows Server-related resources in there you can go and check out. So have a look at that. Has anyone tried MVA? A few of you, well done, okay. I see a few people walking around with the t-shirts on this week as well, so good for you. Okay, usual stuff here, folks. Please complete the eval. There is swag to be won. There's Xboxes and stuff to be won. The code for this one is EXM13, if that makes it easier to find on the eval. So please do fill that in. Do be honest on the evals, but at the same time, be gentle. Do tell us what you thought. Give us feedback. We like to hear about that. So tell us how you thought this was. Maybe you want to hold back until after you've done the exam, but I'd prefer you to fill it out before. If you have any other questions, do stick around. But otherwise, thank you very much for attending. Come and see me if you have any questions at the end. Thank you.